Blog Talk Radio.
Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluwa Mi, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Araba Mi, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogunte Compound Ode Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun, to all the God children, Mojuba Egun, to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun, to all the chiefs, Mojuba Egungun, to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun, to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe, Ashe,
Ashe, welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC, the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights, and New Power Radio Network. We ask that you please support our sponsors, Unity Design, headed up by Arlie Gordon. You can find Arlie on Facebook and as Unity Design on the World Wide Web. And Unity is spelled U-N-I-T-E-E. Please look up him up on Facebook as well as on the World Wide Web at unitydesign.com. Also, please support my co-host this evening, Dr. James Jones. You can find him on Facebook as James Jones, as well as a like and group page for Manhood, Race, and Culture, and on the World Wide Web at manhoodraceculture.com. And last but not least, we never want to forget our confined brothers and sisters behind enemy lines. Please support Unheard Voices, the Free Alabama Movement, and the Free Ohio Movement. Unheard Voices is on Facebook, as well as the Free Ohio Movement and the Free Alabama Movement can be reached at freealabamamovement.com and freeohiomovement.org. So tonight, as always, on Wednesday nights, we have the honor of having my co-host, Dr. James Jones. Peace, Dr. Jones. How are you doing this evening?
I'm great, Queen. I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good hanging in here. A lot of exciting things are coming down the pike, so within the next 30 to 60 days, we should have a really good announcement for our listeners. So I'm excited for what the future holds for all of us because we've been at this quite a while.
Yes, ma'am. Sounds good. Sounds good.
Ashe. How's school going?
You know, school is school. It's a part of it is work duty. You know, a part of it is liberation work. You know, a part of it frustrates you to no end. And then there's another part of it that brings you back to the realization that our people have a very long, long way to go in regards to any lifting up of their consciousness and their mind. It's still at times very daunting and very difficult. But at other times, it's very encouraging and very, you know, very easy work at other times. So I'll just say it like that. So it's work.
I say. Well, you know, it seems like when, you know, sometimes we feel so heavy with the burden of, you know, not knowing, I guess, what the future might hold for us as a group of people. It seems like every time I get discouraged, something else comes along that keeps us pushing a little bit further. So hopefully, you know, it'll continue to grow and continue to foster some things that will actually be able to be manifested out of all this work. So, yeah, keep pushing. And if there's ever anything that we can do to support there on the ground, just let us know.
Yeah, you know, it's what it is at a certain level. You know, it's like I said, there are moments that are very encouraging and liberating, and then there are other moments that really drive home the point to you that this is a job, and there are people mm-hmm. who are behaving and operating like it's a job. And it's very difficult to work around such individuals because their vision is one of a very personal, self-promoting vision. And then you have others whose vision is more liberating and view the work as being something above and beyond just a job, you know. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, we have to come up with a way to be able to have a foot in both of those worlds. Because the irony of the entire situation is that if we fail at having a foot in both worlds, we'll be the ones who are out the door, not those mm-hmm. who are in many ways exploiting the system for and getting from it what it is that they're able to get from it. So it's a tightrope.
Well, tonight this topic for tonight, Am I Still My Brother's Keeper, came up in some conversations, not only, you know, here on Sign of the Times, but in other arenas as well. And, you know, it could very well to apply to us as sisters, too. That just doesn't seem to be that communal brother-to-brother, sister-to-sister relationship like, you know, we once, you know, practiced. It may not have been universal. It may not have been omniscient and omnipresent, but it was there to a certain extent, at least a lot more than what it is in 2017. So it brought up the topic, you know, do our brothers still regard each other as each other's keeper? And, you know, us sisters are going to get together and have the same conversation as well. So, you know, I yield to you, Dr. Jones. I know that you've written a piece on this topic, and just to get your opinion on it before we embark.
You know, the you would love to romanticize this issue and to really say emphatically and immediately that, yes, I, you know, I am my brother's keeper. Yes, you know, I'm there with that. And that's a very idealistic portion of our brain, of our historical memory and what have you. But upon deeper analysis, one really does have to question, is it possible to consider someone who does not consider you a brother via their actions, via their worldview, via the things they say? Is it possible to still consider that person, you know, logically, your brother? And, you know, I've changed on this over the years. And I'm definitely in the camp right now that Chris Rock talked about in one of his stand-ups. And it was quite simply that there's a civil war going on in Black America. And it's between Black folk and, as we put it, the N-word. And they got to go. And I'm feeling that argument more and more and more. It may be age setting in. I'm not sure what it is. But I'm not giving anybody free points, free access, because they have the same skin tone, you know, that they have the same historical experience, because there are people who have decided that they will utilize that for little more than a way to harm the masses of our people. And can I be brothers with someone like that? That's kind of my question, and I came up with no, with an emphatic no, I can't.
Ashe, do you want to go ahead and go into the piece now?
Yeah, I mean, we can do that. We can do that. That's fine. The piece that I wrote is appears on my site, manhoodraceculture.com, and it is titled, "Am I Still My Brother's Keeper? How Should We Answer This Question in 2017? And it reads as follows. There's probably no more hopeful phrase found in the lexicon of African-American men than, and I quote, "I am my brother's keeper," end quote. Within that short five words, a declarative sentence lies an unyielding hope that has bolstered the hopes and aspiration of droves of African-American men at some low point in their life. Unfortunately for Black men, in the 21st century, this declaration of their commitment to being a solidified force against anything that threatens them or the millions of unknown African-American men that they have no tangible connection to has become little more than rhetorical phrase-mongering. Let's be honest about this matter. The vast majority of African-American males harbor some form of beef with one another for reasons that even they cannot articulate. The rage that so many Black men express to their counterparts does not have its genesis in any particular offense. Rather, it is the payoff of being raised within a society that maligns Blackness at every turn. Put simply, Black-on-Black rage is a predictable byproduct of being socialized to view Blackness as an omnipotent negative and an omnipresent problem by an oppressive white media and non-representative educational school curriculum. There's no room to debate that this socialization serves as the primary context for both the development of a toxic manhood and daunting view of all things Black. It is this reality that makes the answering of the important question of, "Am I my brother's keeper?" a convoluted mess. I found that those who answer this query with an unequivocal yes are completing what amounts to a socially appropriate nicety, that reveals their failure to analyze this matter correctly. Truthfully, a much better question is, Do black men consider each other brothers? Despite our fervent desire to answer this question affirmatively, the truth of the matter is that it should only be answered on a case-by-case basis, as our kind has been infiltrated by a host of individuals who maintain a single-minded priority to get ahead materially, even at the cost of compromising our collective well-being. Consider for a moment the sentiments of the late Tupac Amaru Shakur, who cryptically foretold his demise at the hand of a brother in his classic track, Only God Can Judge Me. Tupac asserted, and I quote, "And they say that it's the white man that I should fear, but it's my own kind doing all the killing here," end quote. As you well know, Tupac is not the only brother who has looked down the barrel of a gun that his brother was holding for some unspecified reason. In many ways, those, such as myself, who are holding on to an old collectivist racial construct are operating out of a make-believe black solidarity that has little grounding in either a mythical past or a frightening present. I'm not ashamed to relate that my current interactions with African-American males are governed by an all-too-real caution and well-deserved skepticism. Issues that an extremely vocal minority of black males has made necessary. So although I would like to relate that I am my brother's keeper confidently, I simply can't. My resistance to fully embracing this rhetorical cliche is a result of my living long enough to realize that Chuck D's admonishment that, and I quote, "every brother ain't a brother," end quote, carries significant weight. With the benefit of hindsight, I have begun to view tales of a universal brotherhood that glued black men together in past times as little more than a well-spun fable. In many ways, it does not matter if such times ever existed, as the present is all that matters. And it is this present moment that leads me to the realization that I am not every black man's keeper, because very few of them have either behaved as or have the intention of ever being my brother. Unfortunately, the traditions that forged a collectivist racial identity is largely vanquished from black America. And within that ruin lays the reason that every brother ain't a brother. And there's the piece right there, Queen.
I say, Dr. Jones. Excellent piece, and we'll be referring back to it as we proceed in the conversation, because there are a couple of things that were said. So the first thing I want to, get your understanding on is the origination of us calling each other brother and sister. It's my understanding that it goes back to when we were separated after slavery, and we came across people in our social interactions who very well could be our brothers or our sisters. Is that your understanding of where that phrase originated from, or do you have another understanding of it?
No, I've never heard that articulated that way, and number two, I've never even gave a thought as to, and I think that that's more of a reflection upon the community I was incubated in. Never even gave a thought about that right there, those matters, the origins of us referring to each other as brothers and sisters.
What about going back to the 60s when there was, it was more prevalent in the community?
Well, but, even that, what I'll say is that, and as somebody who has studied and written on black power extensively, I still operate out of, we could have very well we did refer to each other as brothers and sisters and what have you. It is an opportunity for us to expand that quote unquote family circle. Yet at the exact same time, when we are articulating such laudable goals, and I agree that these are laudable goals, but at that time as well, we still have a situation where we were still kind of doing one another in. So beyond it being a very cute rhetorical thing for people to say, it's doing little more than that.
Yeah, I don't regard it as something that's cute at all. I regard it as something that's almost a necessity in order for us to, you know, expand our communal family. And the options of it are frightening to me, to where I would get to the point where I couldn't regard someone who looks like me and is especially, you know, if it's another sister, to where, you know, I think it would be more of a reflection on me than society if I got to the point where I no longer had faith to even think about it and have it cross my mind that this very well could be someone who's related to me. This happens to me here in Cincinnati, where I've been in social engagements and meet people who either know a cousin or are married to a cousin that knows, you know, it happens all the time where we find out our family, who we thought was just a communal family, actually is family to us. So I see it quite the opposite, Dr. Jones. I see it as a necessity in order for us to change the paradigm. And to me, I don't see us treating someone in the street who's just an average Joe even the same way that we would treat a brother or a sister. So to me, I think it's paramount to continue to plant those seeds.
You know, I hear you, and I understand the convoluted nature of black familial constructions and what have you, all the way down to our having fictive kin, the million ways that we are related and what have you, many of which I will say I don't always on the surface believe. I believe that it's comfortable for us to construct these linkages in that way, and that allows something else to occur, I would say, you know, a solidarity that wouldn't be there if we were not terming ourselves in these ways. But all in all, in saying that, I'm more interested and have always been much more interested in the idea of how do we treat one another beyond a mere title, beyond a colloquial greeting and what have you. And it's at that level that we have to be honest, and we need to really judge those moments and those people and those interactions literally on a case-by-case basis, because much of what we are expecting and anticipating, if we have a standard template of expectation, is going to lead us into a situation where we're woefully, woefully disappointed in the actions, behaviors of our very people, of our own people.
Yeah, I don't think that's uncommon. When you are in this type of field area, if these kinds of things concern you, of course there's going to be some disappointment. I mean, that's part of the game. I mean, that's part of the game that that we have to play to a certain extent if we're going to be true to it. And that's part of the game that's used against us, too, to discourage us from ever wanting to go down that path of wanting to be more communal and unifying and, you know, rolling with the punches even to a certain extent to make sure that we're able to continue to move forward and still have as positive an outlook on what the future holds for us and what we're, as I always say, worthy of, you know, what's worth it to us to sacrifice on our own so that the next generations don't, you know, look at the generations that came before them and say, you knew that it was this fucked up and you chose not to do anything about it. So, yeah, I think that's a discussion that we're going to have to continue to have. I'm going to go ahead and open up a mic, 7376, last four digits, 7376. Welcome to Sign of the Times. How are you doing this evening?
Hey, how are you all doing?
Welcome, sis.
Hey.
I'm doing all right.
Good. I'd like to chime in. I'm smack dab in the middle of the two of you. I think we do have to have an openness and kind of wanting to look after our brothers and sisters, but it has to come with that cautious eye. It's like, you know, it's like any love situation. You know, you're open to it, but you can't be so blinded by it. You know, you can't be so dogmatic and say, yes, I'm my brother, sister's keeper across the board, of course. You know, you have to, you do have to recognize, well, is this my sister, is this my brother? Because also on the flip side of your coin, Queen, we have blood relatives that ain't our brothers and sisters who have, you know, turned betrayal and had to deal with things in our household before we even step out into the world. So we do have to navigate that, you know, cautiously. We have, and part of being our brother's keeper, I believe, is checking, you know, those that, you know, those cousins out there that are just out of line, you know. But indeed, when you're doing that, you have to weigh the scenarios to where your energy is better spent too, you know, because you cannot allow them to get out of line at the cost of the community as a whole, at the cost to the family as a whole, you know. So, yeah, I know, you know, that barometer just swings all over the place. And sometimes we go into scenarios, you know, all in thinking that, oh, yeah, this is, you know, this is someone I can really commune with and then find otherwise. But we do have to allow, it's like that initial commitment, you know, what am I going to be, what resource, what value am I going to be to my family? And then we take it from there and, you know, it's all just step by step, you know, cautious as it may be. But, you know, we have to kind of embrace our path if that's the way we want to go. But, of course, not willy-nilly accept everybody, you know, as is, and kind of be prepared, you know, like Dr. said, you got to be prepared to cut them when you need to. And we got to eliminate them, you know, like the body eliminates a virus or cancer. We either have to ostracize them, put them away, away from the vital organs where we need to operate and grow, or eliminate them altogether. Ashe, I yield.
Ashe, I yield to you, Dr. Jones.
You know, I think that those sentiments are spot on, as always. You know, we have blood relatives who are not necessarily behaving in a manner and or pulling their weight, you know, in an appreciable way. You know, and so, you know, it puts us within a very interesting dilemma. And to be honest with you, one of the things that I believe that we can agree on is that the mere fact that people are positioning you in that position where you have to make a decision on what it is that you'll do for them under some of the, what we could really argue are some of the most intense moments of conflict, is highly revealing and highly illuminating in regards to what it is that, how they feel about you, what they expect you to do. And it's, you know, friends and family don't put each other in those types of intense, tenuous situations. And the fact that that some of them not only do that, but also do it repeatedly is really, really, really revealing about their level of affinity, their level of commitment in regards to who you are, what you're about, and what they can even foresee you being in the future. And I yield with that.
Indeed.
Ashe. Sister Andriana, I feel you. I feel, you know, both sides of the scenario. Like, it's not a hard thing to do to become disenchanted with our people, because, you know, we've been through a lot and have had the opportunity to engage and unify, you know, for quite some time. And one of the things that I know that has held us back is the fact that we've got these gatekeepers in the community who have knowledge and things like that choose not to share it, to empower us with, and that's been an issue. There's been an atmosphere created of distrust when we have had the faith in the communal family and things go awry and not go the way they're supposed to. But we also have a lot of things that have happened to us just because we are, and those things factor into the relationships that we've been able to build or not build with each other, even, you know, let alone brother to brother, but father to son even. So we've got a lot of things that we could easily say, well, you know, just because it's like this, then, you know, forget it. I'm not going to even bother putting myself on the line and making myself vulnerable to this process. Mm-hmm. But I just think the expense of that is too high for us, especially right now, considering our political environment, our social environment, our health environment, our educational environment. You know, if it's not clear that we need to save ourselves and rebuild our relationships, then I don't know how much more clear it can possibly be. It's one thing to look at it too. You know, some folks say if they belong to the same labor union, they call everybody in that particular union brother and sister. And so are we looking at changing our concept of what a brother and a sister is? Or, you know, are we going to stay on this path and try to coalesce amongst us first before we go reaching outside of our race, which, you know, we also have a tendency to do, and I deal with that.
I like, you know what, there's two good points you brought up. You know, we do have to start from within. We have to love ourselves, and when I mean love ourselves, I don't mean us as a community. I mean get back to us. You can't love anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You can't help anybody, keep anybody, if you're not keeping yourself. If you're not, you know, in that arena of your own self-discipline and self-awareness that comes with growth. And, you know, we want to sidestep that issue. I mean, I don't mean we as just a community. I mean we as human race. We always want to sidestep that community. We don't want to hold up the mirror to ourselves to get past our own demons that will prevent us or shadow or even color that view of how we see what we think of as our brother, our sister. You know, we have to, you know, clean the fog off the mirror and clear that image so that we can have a better way to judge, you know, how someone's coming to us and evaluate it that way to see if it's a viable union, you know. And and then, too, I do believe we need to, you know, keep within our racial community, our cultural community, before stepping out, because too often when we do step out, we end up getting diverted, and, you know, and then that's where the opportunity avails for the others to position us in ways that pit us against each other, lose sight of our own focus. And again, part of that losing sight is not wanting to look at ourselves. You know, it's easy to you know, point the finger or hold the mirror or even champion someone else's cause, because that doesn't take the real work. The real work is your own cause. The real work is developing your own self. The real work is your own family, be it your microcosmically blood family or your extended, you know, communal family. That's the work. Ashe, I yield.
Ashe. Ashe, and you're right. Self-love has to come first, and you're absolutely right. Unless we love ourselves and have it, you know, in abundance for ourselves, like, you know, I look in the mirror sometimes in the morning and say, I love you, girl, and I say, I love you, too. And we have a full conversation, especially if I stub my toe getting out of bed in the morning, like, oh, damn, like, this could go two ways right now, like, or if I, you know, run my stockings or something, like, and I do still wear stockings. Thank you very much. But anyway, if I run my stockings, you know, I could look at it two ways. I could put them on anyway and wear some pants or put some lotion on my legs and go on out the door. So it's all about how we choose to approach this thing. Like, and, you know, we've got, and you're absolutely right. I can't argue or differ with you whatsoever about that self-love, because it definitely is key, and it has an effect on everything. How you, even how your coffee tastes in the morning has an effect on, you know, the self-love is. So I agree with you, sis. I definitely do, and I yield. Dr. Jones?
Yes, ma'am. I'm here just listening to y'all.
Well, come on in. We got a seat for you on the couch.
I'm sitting here. I'm just listening. There's a reason you got two ears and one mouth. You should listen twice as much as you talk. So
Okay, so Dr. Jones, let me ask you this now. You experienced the Million Men March the first time, and I know when my brother went, and I watched it, and had little babies at home, and it really gave me a sense of hope for when our men came home, and there was this real sense of brotherhood established then. And it didn't happen. And I was just wondering what your opinion was on that attempt at brotherhood from the Millions gatherings, and what happened? Like, you have any idea why there was not that continued momentum to continue to solidify that brotherhood?
I believe that there were some attempts beyond the Million Man March to extend that moment of brotherhood, let me say that, to give many of the brothers that I know, I did not go. And the reason I did not go is I was a graduate student at Ohio State at the time, and my funding was I was going to school basically for free as a graduate assistant. And I'm the only, and when I say the only, I'm not talking about there was another brother or sister present that was a sellout. I was the only black person in the entire department. And it was a major thing about, watching me to see if I showed up for the Million Man March or went to the Million Man March. And what I did was I actually went to work that day. And I walked all the way through the department to make sure everyone saw me, spoke to people I'd never spoken to before in my life and would never speak to again. And after that, I walked out and went and sat in front of CNN and watched the Million Man March on TV. I say that too, and also while I was watching, I saw some brothers I knew who, were in the drug game, were in all kind of nefarious activities and what have you. But what I'll say about the Million Man March, and it's sort of tied into my developed understanding of what love is, and it is this, that those feelings and those movements are going to invariably fail if they're not based upon strength, honor, and loyalty. If your sense of love is predicated and rests upon the idea of an emotion, well, your emotions are going to change several times in a day. And I think that we could all agree that there are days that we grow up, that we wake up, and we really don't like ourselves. So can you imagine tying your commitment to something to your emotions? So for me, to be honest with you, with the Million Man March, I knew going in that it was going to be a very emotional thing. But I also realized that there needs to be an infrastructure to deal with these issues that are plaguing black men that go beyond emotion. One of my favorite quotes of Dr. Phil McGraw is that we handle emotional problems with emotional solutions. That's not what I saw being offered. What I saw being offered was what Dr. John Henry Clark referred to as a Hollywood revolution, where there was lights, camera, action. And we taped it, we felt good about it, X, Y, and Z. But in no way, at no point, did the things that were forcing brothers to assemble in D.C., seeking help, and in many ways we need to recognize it as a large cry, so to speak, a crying out in regards to a spiritual crisis among African-American men. There was nothing to address that beyond us, a whole bunch of hurt individuals assembling together. And when they went back to their indigenous communities, That child support payment that they couldn't make before was still waiting on them. That unemployment that they were dealing with before was still very prevalent in their face. So, you know, that's my reading on why. You know, and it's the exact same thing that happens repeatedly to our people. You know, we get amped up emotionally, and, you know, you look at what it takes to rally our people to, quote-unquote, any type of activism, and what you'll end up finding is that there are certain triggers within our people, and undoubtedly the vast majority of those triggers are emotionally based. And as long as we are reacting that way from an emotional basis, not from a politicized basis, we're only good as long we're kind of like a car that has been given half a tank of gas. Look here, we can get on the road and we can floor it, and we can keep up with other people. But once that half a tank of gas subsides and that car stops, you know, hurling forward, you know, we're back to square one. And for many of us who have reflected on this and think about this, these types of things, the truth of the matter is that we're tired of that, and we're looking for something that could best be termed something that is real, and I yield with that.
What does that look like, Dr. Jones? Something that is real, what does that look like?
You know, I think that it starts wholeheartedly with us divorcing the idea of our liberation from emotion. I think that we go back to basics. And part of going back to basics is quite simply being able to break bread with one another, being able to have a friendly conversation with one another, being able to honestly say within yourself how you feel when you see African-American men. So frequently, you know, we're around here talking, and we know that we're fronting. Oh, yeah, my brother, you know this. And you know that deep in your heart, not only do you hate that particular brother, but you also have enough hatred and disdain and disappointment in your heart to cover brothers that you don't even know. So we have to divorce it from anything emotional. Let me say that first. And we need to build independent, sensible, comprehensive, holistic programs that are dealing, that are led by black folk, but also dealing with what we know are the sources of from whence our problems are coming. And a few of those sources, as you well know, is being able for black men, and I'll deal with black men in particular, being able to be positioned in a situation where you feel, number one, that you are loved, number two, that you matter, and number three, that you're going to be able to go out into this world and do your best, embrace what the world has for you, and be given a decent chance of success. I'm reminded of, and I always liken so much and refer things back to hip-hop lyrics. I think about it, and this just popped in my head, a lyric that Tupac said. He says, "I know my destiny is hell, but did I fail?" And I think that in those types of sentiments, that's what we need to be trying to address within our community. And it is building and developing an infrastructure that allows for African-Americans to be agents in pretty much each and every aspect of their existence. We need to have a reliable and reasonable path for African-American men to be what I would term marriageable. And that means gainfully employed with some benefits and able to take care of any woman and children that he produces with that woman. I don't see that as even being talked about right now. We're still running around here with our hands held out, begging white folk for a position, begging white folk for an opportunity. And rest assured that we will very well do each other in if it means at any moment us continuing our dependence upon white folk. We're not trying to lose that job by helping our brother. We will not risk our job by helping our brother, and we don't have the courage and the vision to break off on our own and start our own, which in many ways is the supreme form of cowardice that any people could have, and also a subconscious, implicit admission that my people won't support anything that I do because we're not solidified. So that's what that looks like to me, Queen.
Sister Andrian, what is your perspective on that and the future for us if they are as Dr. Jones has described?
We have to. It's a daunting task, but I mean, it's nothing that we can't do. It's just that we have to make sure we hit those facets, and all of the facets he mentioned are very, very spot on. We have to do it concurrently. We can't say, okay, we have this, then we have that. We have to, this is where we do keep our brother and embrace him and hug him and love him and put him in a place where he can be a productive member of our community. It's interesting that, you know, you brought in marriageable, because we have a disconnect with that in our community, I believe, where we think that, building any relationships, sexual and male-female ties, we hold that in a separate arena than we do the progression of our economic standing. When they go hand in hand, nothing is ever isolated and separate that way, because one feeds into the other. And we are so quick to jump in the bed with, anything that looks like, Nicki Minaj or, some rapper or whatever, so quick, without even thinking about how, what's to come of this, what's the future of the progeny that results in that union. And we do have to get back, it's like you owe it as a keeper of your family to that person, that individual you bring into the world, to help lay that foundation of how that's going to progress, how that goes forth. How they choose, their mate, and then make it into the world and grow into the community as a part of the community in a very honorable way. And we're skipping that beat. We, will lay down with each other, or even come to think we're going to love someone in a relationship really kind of willy-nilly. We don't think about how that looks and how that's supposed to progress. We're just hoping that, we're still attracted to each other in a couple of months. It is still wrapped up in that emotion, and we don't foster that the integrity of it, in any type of strength and honor. We just take it so day by day, and we take it for granted that it either is or isn't. And a lot of what comes with that is a distrust in and of itself. The male-female dynamic in our community is almost laid in a sense of distrust, one leg in and one leg out, where we don't have the courage to just say, okay, this is a good person, this is a good, woman, she's really working hard and forging a way in the world, and this is a good, man doing the same. And we can't get past our past hurts, those past emotions, to see them with a clearer eye, to honor them and the strength that they stand in to go forth. So, it's a whole lot wrapped up in there, just starting even at our seed, at the onset. And then from there we can go and, hold these good people up and give them the support they need, first in the family unit and then into the community to perpetuate that, because once it gets started, it should be ongoing and constant growth. But we're spinning our wheels in mud, because we haven't cleaned up the foundation.
Ashe, let me toss this out here. Two things. One, do you think that the concept of, Dr. Jones has used the word emotionalism, do you think the concept of how men view emotionalism is different from how women view it? And what is the difference, in your opinion, on the definition of emotionalism and having a passion about a thing? And I yield. Mm-hmm. To whoever wants to go first.
I'll tackle that one. I think there's a such thing as a passionate emotionalism, where you just get wrapped up in your emotion, and you think it's so strong, you think it's passion. But I think real passion comes with action. And that's where we lose steam. That's where the car runs out of gas, you know, because we don't have the true passion. We can't see all facets of what it really is, you know, in full embrace, you know. So we're all charged up, full of emotion, you know, even ready to go, but we haven't prepared ourselves. You know, it's like, it's almost like the stalker. Stalker is passionate. It's a fanatic, the ultimate fan, you know. So they've already researched and looked all around whatever their object of desire is, you know. But we are not there. We have that emotion, and it's stirred up so much. We want what we want so much, but we don't take the action around it to give it the traction to get our desire across, you know. That's how I see it.
You know, the thing for me is that emotionalism most definitely has a role in everything that we do. You know, it's what in many ways allows us to prioritize certain things and really say, well, at this moment, you know, this is really what we need to be focused upon. And that's highly understandable. Yet at the exact same time, emotionalism is not and never will be a suitable replacement for the creation of logical plans. Mm-hmm. It never will be, you know. And the problem is that if we don't use that emotionalism, that fleeting emotionalism as fuel to stay up all night creating a strategy to attack the system, because the system that is doing black folk in is not one that is occurring face-to-face and in the streets. It's not. So if you fail to realize that and you utilize all of your emotional energy by going out into the streets and marching around, wearing out some shoe leather and coming up with some very cute songs, well, the enemy is not there.
And the enemy
and
ain't emotional.
You basically now run out of gas because you went out there, you know, you tried, and nothing worked. Well, the reason it didn't work is because you didn't utilize that emotionalism, that blessing, that charge, to go ahead and really allow it to be fuel for the creation of a movement. You allowed that to be a moment that, you know, you actually probably would have been better off served if all of you went to 24-hour fitness and got a good workout in.
Yeah.
That would allow you to burn off that anger, that angst and what have you. But in regards to it in any way being useful to you creating a plan, you wasted that moment and you allowed some things that should have, you know, never creeped in to creep in, you know. And just as I said with the Million Man March, these brothers, they got, you know, we going up there, we going to see Farrakhan, you know, this and that, we brothers, X, Y, and Z. Well, when you return back home and you realize that your pockets are even more empty because you spent the little money that you had getting to D.C., paying for a hotel room and what have you, well, now you're back in your indigenous community. Emotion is gone. You're dead broke. And invariably, it's going to be those conditions that lead you to committing a property crime against another brother who, ironically, may have very well been at the same march that you were at. So, you know, emotionalism, you know, getting emotional, having compassion, having sympathy, we're human. We definitely have that. But we can't allow that to disrupt and disturb what is a scientific process.
Mm-hmm.
It's predictable why some people make it and other people don't make it. And until we utilize that emotion to begin investigating those things that really matter, we're going to continue to lose from day one to day forever, and I yield.
Yes.
Ashe, we're almost to the top of the hour, and I'd just like to say this in, before we get ready to go to break, is that, you know, I know that if we didn't approach things a certain way, we wouldn't even be able to have this conversation right now because we have been committed. We have rolled with the punches. We have been here when no one else was, and so, you know, again, I don't know how anybody else would define that, but I definitely don't look at it as simple emotionalism. We have to be passionate about this work. Otherwise, we might as well be working at a car wash somewhere. So we're going to get ready to take a quick break. You're listening to Sign of the Times, brought to you by New Power Radio Network and the UAC. We'll be right back.
Hey, my beautiful people. This is Andreanne, and I'm host of the show Holistic Health and Healing on the New Power Radio Network. We all know that without your help, nothing else is worthwhile, right? I mean, what's the point of being rich if you end up spending all the time you have left and all the money you've made on the way to get back the health that was neglected on the journey? Well, let's get back to making our health and well-being a priority. Then the wealth and prosperity will automatically flow. So join us as we dive into all matters of health and well-being holistically in all areas of your life. We'll discuss the causes and effects of diseases and medical conditions and what you can do to heal from these effects. You'll hear suggestions on how to best utilize the medical establishment for your benefit instead of their profit. We'll explore all of the latest innovations in health and well-being and how to apply them in all areas of your life. In the end, we must remove everything that's creating and maintaining the pain and disease in our lives in order to treat our wounds and to heal. Here's to your holistic health. Many blessings. Peace.
Hello. My name is Dr. James Thomas Jones III, and I am the author of a new and exciting book titled Foolish Floyd, The Life and Times of an African-American Contrarian. Now, I'm certain that you know someone like Floyd, 50-something years old from Greenwood, Mississippi, who has all of the answers to Black America's problems, if only we would stop being so stubborn and listen to him. Let me give you a sample of the wit and wisdom that one receives from Foolish Floyd. When told that he was an African-American, Floyd responded, "I'm black. Ain't never been to no damn Africa, and neither have you." When I asked Floyd to go and testify about a brutal crime that he had seen committed in his community, his response was, "Let's say that I do go and tell the police who did it. Hell, everyone in the Fifth Ward knows who did it. That ain't no big secret." The next thing you know, old Floyd is going to be down at the police station picking these bastards out of the lineup. Then I have to go to court and testify against them in public. The entire time, I'm living next door to their people. No, sir, I will pass on getting my head blown off. Let someone else play the hero. I would rather be alive. If you think that you would like to read more about Floyd, please visit Amazon.com and purchase a copy of Foolish Floyd, The Life and Times of an African-American Contrarian. Thank you.
Only God can judge us.
Is that right?
Only God, man.
Nobody else.
Nobody else.
All you other motherfuckers, get out of my business.
Really? Perhaps I was blind to the facts. Stabbed in the back, I couldn't trust my own home. Just a bunch of dirty rats. Will I succeed? Paranoid from the weed. And hocus pocus, try to focus, but I can't see. And in my mind, I'm a blind man doing time. Look to my future, cause my past is all behind me. Is it a crime to fight for what is mine? Everybody's gone. Tell me what's the use in trying. I've been trapped since birth. Cautious, cause I'm cursed. And fantasies of my family in the hurt. And they say it's the white man I severe. But it's my own time doing all the killing here. I can't lie. Ain't no love for the other side. Jealousy inside. Make them wish to die. Oh, my Lord. Tell me what I'm living for. But it hurts, I'm walking through the city.
and they wonder why we suicidal, running round strapped. Mr. Police, please try to feed it. It's a million motherfuckers stressing just like me. Only God can judge. Not kill me can only make me stronger.
For real.
I don't see why everybody feels as though they gotta tell me how to live my life.
You know?
Let me live, baby. Let me live.
Pac, I feel ya. Keep serving it on the realer. For instance, say a player hating marks out to kill ya. Would you be wrong for bucking a nigga to the pavement? He gon' get me first if I don't get him. Who start praying? Ain't no such thing as self-defense in the court of law. So judges, when we get to where we're going, we're in the cross. That's real. Got him, lift him, crept the fuck up on him. Sold a half a million tips. Now everybody want him. After talking behind my back like a bitch would. Telling them niggas you could say the fuck I wish you would. To be the same motherfuckers in your face. That'll rush up in your place to get your safe. Knowing you on that paper chase. Grass, glass, big screen and leather couch. My new shit is so petty, already sold the Kia ounce. Bitch, remember Tupac and Forte? Them same two brothers dodging bullets representing the Bay. Pop, when you was locked down, that's when I'll be around. Start climbing up the trunk, so sick, but they tried to clown. That's why they ride the bandwagon, still be dragging, selling lies. Don't think I don't see you haters.
Welcome back to Sign of the Times, everyone. Sign of the Times, again, is brought to you by the UAC and New Power Radio Network. Welcome back, Dr. Jones and Sister Andrian.
Good to be back.
Glad to be back.
Ashe. I had to rock that pock for a minute. I went and got it when you brought it up, Dr. Jones. So, yeah, it's all in love. It's all in strength.
Right.
So, Dr. Jones, can you reintroduce tonight's topic and, bring us back into focus, if you will?
Yeah, tonight's topic was dealing with answering in 2017 and 21st century this larger question of, am I my brother's keeper? And the truth of the matter is that within the context that we're dealing right now, it's a significant question that African-American males in particular are going to have to deal with. And that answer is muddled, convoluted, and in many ways there is no correct answer, I guess, that we can say in regards to the answering that question. Because
sure.
It's one that is, for lack of a better way to be able to claim it,
okay.
that every black man has to answer on a one-on-one basis with others in regards to other black men. And I yield with that.
Ashe, Sister Andrian, I'd like to ask you, what is your opinion on am I my sister's keeper?
I was glad you asked that because I was just thinking about that. I think that, we honestly have to kind of push forward as a family unit. So male and female should not be separated in this. You know, we may come together as we plan as sisters and moving forward, but in order for us to kind of regroup and kind of situate our place in all of this, we have to come together as a unit. The Million Man March was a great push with knowing we can gather in those numbers. And it was also a great way to show ourselves that, you know, our men can go out into the world and stand. Of course, it, you know, unfortunately lost its steam, but I think, underestimate our sisters' place in this. And I don't mean this, to denigrate in any way. I just think that we overlook the power that we as melanated women have in this whole situation. You know, we are the emotional and spiritual bedrock of that. So it's up to us actually to give our men support to get out there into the world. So it's we have to, you know, even as we come together as a camaraderie of sisters, come up with ways that we can better support our men if we want them to be the ones supporting us. And paving the way into the world and giving us the material support to grow a family, to build a family, then we have to give them that support to do so and recognize that that's our place to do so. Recognize we have more than enough power to do that, you know. And, you know, emotionally, there's no difference in expression of that emotion or even passion. But we still always, you know, have to come together still logically, logistically, and kind of figure out how we're going to do it in a repetitive sort of way. That's kind of where we're – one of the steps we're missing. We don't have the forms, the framework to reproduce it. You know, we have these isolated families out there that seem like they're successfully paving their way, but – how is that consistently reproduced, you know, honorably, that we can pass that on, you know? And we've never really established that. And, you know, in our 150 years, you know, post, we haven't been able to really, you know, sit that down, that we need to do this in honor. Okay, do what? We need to, you know, set up this framework. What framework? We haven't, you know, put that out there as a way to just operate as a collective unit, as a family unit, you know. So we have to, that's where we as sisters have to actually step up and recognize our power, put on our shoes and our big girl panties and say, it's not just about the Million Man March. It's not even about the Million Woman March. It's us coming together, and how do we build our family? That I yield.
We've talked about that, and even when going back as far as the time we were asking for 90 days unity around the new Black Code, I mean, that is mentioned in there that we support our brothers, mm-hmm. And, you know, they support each other, and we support our sisters, and they support each other, and we support the community, yeah, family as a whole. I couldn't agree with you more that that definitely is the ultimate goal for us, to be able to coalesce in that way. But mm-hmm. I also know that we have different ways of that we deal with each other as sisters, and brothers have a way that they deal with each other as brothers. And so in that, we also have the potential to build more strength amongst the sisterhood, so that when we do get to the point of either, you know, engaging with our mates, engaging with our families, engaging with our children or our community, we're as whole as we can possibly be, and can always rely on that sister circle, if you will, as a, you know, access, able to be accessed for additional strength should we need it. So that's one of the things that that we've talked about when we had Sisters of the Soul on. That was what we based our conversations around, is solidifying that sister circle so we could be as strong as we possibly could be in all other aspects. So, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And now in, I guess, finding our way and making sure that we are able to love ourselves first, be able to put emotionalism in its proper perspective along with the passion and vision and things like that that it takes for us to move forward. Is there hope for restoring or being able to establish for those that have never had that concept in mind of being our brother's keeper or our sister's keeper? Is that still possible? And I yield.
You know, I think undoubtedly it's still possible. You know, the old cliche that anything is possible. But the truth of the matter is that until we really begin to strip away much of the ilk, the gunk that we've gotten from Western civilization, until we're able to even recognize that it's gunk, that it's something that, although it's been with us our entire lives, it's something that is most certainly not warranted or wanted and should be discarded by any means necessary. But even in saying that, I'm also forced to, and this is something that Sister Adriana talked about, the idea of African-American males being the head of the movement and their almost total disregard in many instances. And I'm, of course, speaking about a select class of brothers, their total abandonment of black women, so to speak. And we need to look no further than the very interesting comment that Stokely Carmichael makes when he's the head of Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, where he says that the role of women in the movement is prone, meaning on their back with their legs open. We have to reexamine all of those types of things. We have to have these conversations that are in truth. You know, conversations such as sexism was one of the things that really did lead black women to leave in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It was also an issue that became very prevalent within even a very progressive organization, such as the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, where you had some brothers who were maybe not as politically educated in regards to gender equality, and they brought that gunk that we carried with us from Western civilization and really did everything that they could to apply it within the Panther Party, within a lot of our quote-unquote revolutionary organizations. So, you know, it is possible, but we need to go into a period of introspection, recognition, and to go across that very painful process of learning and understanding that everything that you know, everything that you learn, everything that you think that you know is actually something that may very well, for us to be liberated, need to be extricated from your soul, from your mind, your body, and your soul. And I yield with that.
Right on. You know, it's like the movie The Matrix. Everybody's not ready to be unplugged. And I hate to sound so cynical about it, but sometimes you have to approach people. Those that guard the matrix so strongly, they got to go. And everybody's not going to make it. And as much as we like to bring everyone along, we have to accept that realism that, you know, everybody is not going to make it. Even the ones who we may consider, you know, kind of innocence in it, we have to definitely decide consciously how much energy we're going to put towards any, you know, individual, any group, you know, when we bring them into the fold and open them up into, you know, different courses of action. And, you know, we have to hold them to a very high regard, and holding them into those principles, into our seven principles, if they stand for that, if they can, you know, even if they don't have the habit, if they're attempting to stand to that, you know, then that's the hope, you know. But if they're not even trying, if there's no honor, there's no integrity, next, you know, because our foundation has to be strong. If this is to propagate, it has to be, we can't afford those missing, those weak links, you know.
Exactly.
Those waver.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And they have to be.
And that's why this core group is so small to this day. You know, it can shake people up. It can cause people to get discouraged. It can get into personality conflicts that seem to be more prevalent than the bigger mission of accomplishing a goal. So you're absolutely right. We've got some hurdles to overcome.
Yeah. And it's not emotional. We do. It ain't personal. It ain't emotional. Guess what? The enemy
is not
emotional or personal to them too. It just, you know, they see us as a goal. You know, they know it, and they use our emotionalism against us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they promote Black Lives Matter. They were the ones out in the neighborhood feeding money to get men to the Million Man March because they wanted to see that emotion grow. Because they knew that the momentum of that, they needed to pour resources into that. And they also know that we don't have a plan beyond that. So I think we do need to pull back those emotionalistic actions, you know, that are driven that way. Pull that back and reassess our real resources and going forward. and then use that and to propel and motivate us to other things, more proactive things that we can establish and get our agenda on, you know, in the play.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've got scholars who have left information for us to be able to use and to access. And I think that that's another thing that we miss, if you will, is putting some of the things that have been proven to work, even if they work at a 70% rate, it's better than nothing. It's better than speculating on what could or couldn't happen from an easy chair. You know, it takes work. It takes commitment. It takes to engage our people right where they are, not where, you know, we think they should be or by a certain age or whatever. Like, you know, everybody's going to come into this conversation at different times and points in their lives and with different experiences and even baggages that they're often carrying. So at any point, but that doesn't give us a reason to discount what that they have to offer or the potential that they have. And that's what I think has enabled us to be able to continue pushing past any personalities or personal differences or angst or bills not getting paid or any suffrages that we may have gone through even in our personal lives, again, to get this far, you know, with what we have and have experienced. So, yeah, it's deep. And the more we grow and come across different people who help take us to the next level, help us continue to come together faithfully, regardless, like still come together. I think that circle is going to continue to grow, and it's going to, but that inner core is going to always be what it is, you know, because of the foundation that's already been laid. So, you know, that's my two cents. That's my opinion. That's how I see it. And I don't know. You know, how others who may be just listening to Sign of the Times, others who may have speculation on the broader goal of what we're trying to accomplish or whatever, how they see it, you know. But all I know is that I wake up passionate every day because if I didn't, mm-hmm. I certainly wouldn't have been able to even survive half the hiccups that we've had to survive both on an individual basis as my family and as a community. Y'all seen, you know, what happened this past Sunday here in my city. You know, 17 people shot in a nightclub where, you know, when I used to go out clubbing, the worst thing that it would do is somebody steal something on somebody's dress or something or, you know, a suit or something, and they start clowning. But it never got to the point where, you know, people were shot, like numerous people were shot. And it's my understanding that the brother that did pass away, his head was blown off. So it's we're living in different times. We're living in different eras, and all of us have our own shit to deal with. And nobody's looking at this like the rose-colored glasses, or as Brother L, you know, tried to paint last week that we're gonna all of a sudden wake up and be in this utopia. Nobody's approaching this from that naive of a perspective, but. You know, again, I'll say this again, like we're worth every ounce of blood, sweat, and tears that it's taken to even get this far, you know, both on a personal and professional level through the work that we've been able to do. So fed a lot of children, tied a lot of shoes, and all of that, you know, counts. It is what it is. And like I said, you know, we all come to the table at different points and with different perspectives, and I yield.
For that. If you may, I have a question. I wonder why, so we know we can garner that type of support for a million man march, you know, a million woman march. What do you all think is the issue? Why can't we get that same support for a million, you know, people against McDonald's? Because, you know, that would make an impact. That would, when you hit that establishment in the pocketbook, they take note.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they definitely will be like, oh, hold on. It's just like the bus boycott. That made them take note. One, they didn't believe we would do it. Didn't believe we were doing it. And then when we were in it, they were like, what?
well, we can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because we have a lot of financial resources that leave our community, you know. So why, you know, we want to, is this a matter of lack of self-honor, lack of self-integrity? Is this a lack of courage where we know we're going to get a certain result if we hit them really hard? What thoughts do you all have on that?
I yield to Dr. Jones first.
You know, the thing for me is that, and this is one of the things that often gets me in trouble with our people, is the realization that if we're really being honest about it, that our people are akin to individuals who are getting ready to go out and play the New England Patriots on a good day. They're already defeated before they go out there and engage their opponent. And when you factor in also, and I believe that this is probably the most crucial thing to understanding why we continually are stuck in the exact same place that we've been, and will often fight those who are trying to move us from that sorry place, is that African Americans have some form, some level, the average African American has some form or some level of mental disease that has largely not been diagnosed. They hate themselves. And as a result of consuming all of these images, which are hateful images of their own people, it comes out in their lack of faith. It comes out in low self-esteem. It comes out in disbelief. You know, I can't tell you how many meetings I've been a part of. And these are meetings that are, quote unquote, supposed to be aimed at doing business, black folk doing business with one another. And the initial statement that has been made is, you know, because niggas can't do no business with each other. And it puts you in a position of, well, why are we even here? Right. Are we just, you know, having a mental exercise? What is going on? Because obviously you guys don't believe that we can do what it is that we're talking about. And without faith, in a ability to work, an ability to do the things that are not glamorous, that are never going to be captured on television cameras and what have you, we're going nowhere. And so, you know, you talk about boycotting McDonald's. I mean, I'll tell you how to get black folk to boycott McDonald's. It's very easy. Put Ronald McDonald in blackface. Say that what he's presenting is something that is positive to the black psyche and to black health. We will no longer engage it. We will go away from it. All of the things that we've said historically about McDonald's and about fast food will instantaneously come together like Voltron or some superhero, and we'll not only regurgitate it, it's not that we haven't heard it, but we'll also take definitive steps to fight against it. You know, it's unfortunate that with the mental condition that our people have, the sick mental condition that they have, it's unfortunate that you need the presence of whites to remind us that we all we got. Without that, if whites never offended us, if they never said anything bad about us, we would go to our deaths humming, singing, dancing, and rapping. And I yield with that.
Yeah, I'm trying to break this cycle because I agree wholeheartedly with a lot of what you said, in that we are sickened, right? We're poisoned. And so health-wise, that's the cycle that, you know, I can't get in that vicious cycle. How do I stop, you know, the want of self-hatred enough to stop poisoning? And because the cycle is, you poison yourself, which leads to more self-hate, because now you're feeling bad about yourself, you got all of these diseases and stuff, but you still perpetuate the same self-hate, and you can't even find a viable solution to get out of the cycle of sickness.
I don't know if I'm going to do a video on blackface, though.
I just want to contribute that, there is another million body attempt to have an impact on this government and the society through the Million Prisoner March that's coming up this August, and it's supposed to be held in D.C., and I share the concern that you have that people get excited about the wrong shit too often, and we can't get them to really focus on the things that are going to have the biggest and the quickest impact on us. People are going to be spending money to get there and things like that. So, you know, what we're proposing to do is have something in our state and see if it has the same type of impact. Because, you know, everything with the state and the government starts locally anyway. So that's one perspective on that gathering effort. And two, there were not, Meanie's calling me, there were not a million people who were involved in the strike that took place last September 9th that the Confined Citizens did in conjunction with outside support, and they refused to go to work on that particular day, and it did have an impact. And there were not a million prisoners who participated in that, but it did have an effect. Now, there was some consequences and repercussions behind it, which we expected, because that's just, you know, what the oppressor does. He does not take any sort of backlash kindly, and will do whatever by any means necessary, which we haven't been able to master to do. To have that same approach by any means necessary, this, that, and the other needs to be done. But it did have an impact. Looking forward to doing it again on a larger, even larger scale this September the 9th in recognition of the ACA uprising. So there are things that have had the type of impact that we need them to have, but we just need to continue to expand and continue to grow. And there are going to be soldiers who, you know, as Malcolm said, you know, revolutions are bloody. And in some, you know, some shape, form, or fashion, we know and need to prepare ourselves for some sort of suffrage or backlash from it. But we can't let that hold us back from seeking truth to power and by any means necessary. And with that, Dr. Jones, I know that you have to get ready for your next broadcast. And so I yield to you for any closing remarks. And do you have any concept or ideas on how we could approach this dialogue on next Wednesday?
You know, one of the things that I would like to do next week, and I'll leave you to create the title for this, something dealing with African-American men and African-American women, the seemingly innate discord that occurs among them. And I'll tell you what's sparking this thought. I was leaving work last night, and I happened to chance upon I don't know if it was a lover's quarrel or what have you, between a brother by the name of Darian, and I didn't catch the sister's name, but she's pleading with him about, I guess he went to visit another female or something like that, and just, it looked like a total charade of black love. It could have been put in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s. Let's have a look at how do African American men view African American women, and how do sisters view brothers?
I like that. Dun, 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 dun.
No, but you know what? We gotta get at it.
Yes. Okay, Dr. Jones. I'm glad you left that creative piece up to me, because I'm gonna need to think about this one and how to make that one work. I say. So I might be calling you Sister Andrea. I'm just letting you know now. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Jones. Thank you, Sister Andrea. Did you have anything that you wanted to say in closing, sis?
No, I'm eternally hopeful, and I'm just gonna keep on plugging along.
Ashe. And I'm kind of disappointed that we didn't get more any brothers to call in and push one tonight, because I really wanted to, you know, hear from them on, you know, how they dealt with each other. And I think sometimes we can learn from that, you know, how our brothers choose to relate with each other. And, you know, even when they don't agree, like, it's always good to hear brothers be able to decipher and to work things out. So I'm disappointed, and I might be inboxing me a few people here in a few minutes. And,
but we can read the code.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to show up, man. I look for you, and I don't see your number pop up on my screen. Okay. Well, tomorrow night, we're probably going to have a listening session. We've been really discussing off the air Blueprint for Black Power and the work of Dr. Amos Wilson and putting some of those things back into the community. So thank you, Sister Andrea. Thank you, Dr. Jones. Tomorrow night it will be a listen and learn session. We'll see you at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here on Sign of the Times. This is Queen Tahira. I love you. I'll see you tomorrow. Peace.
Big sight. New. Hank. Hook up. Big sight.
Yeah.
Y'all know how this shit goes, you know.
All eyes on me.
Buffalo.
Roll up in the club.
Yeah, right.
All eyes on me. All eyes on me.
You know what?
I bet you got it twisted, you don't know who to trust. So many player-hating niggas trying to sound like us. Say they ready for the bump, but I don't think they know it. Straight to the depths of hell is where them cowards going. Well, are you still down, nigga? Holler when you see me. And let these devils be sorry for the day they finally freed me. I got a caravan of niggas every time we ride. Hitting motherfuckers up when we pass by. Until I die, live the life of a boss player. Cause even when I'm hot, fuck with me and get boss later. The future's in my eye. Cause all I want is cash and things. I'm 5 double O, being smart. Flashy brain, bitches pursue me like a dream. Been known to disappear before your eyes, it's like a dope thing. It seemed my main thing was to be major paid. The game sharper than the motherfucking razor blade. Save money, bring bitches, bitches bring lies. One nigga getting jealous and motherfuckers die. Depend on me like the first and 15. They might hold me for a second, but these folks won't get me. We got four niggas and low riders and ski masks screaming thug like every time they pass. All eyes on me, little life of a thug nigga.
Keep your head up, nigga, make these motherfuckers suffer. Up in the bins, burning rubber. The
until the day I die. Live a life as a boss player.
All eyes on me. All eyes on me.
Live a life as a thug nigga until the day I die. Live a life as a boss player.
All eyes on me.
All eyes on me.
Pay attention, my nigga. See how that shit go? Nigga walk up in this motherfucker and be like, ding.
Kind of like a thug, nigga. Till the day I die. Them like a bitch. Cause even getting high.
Every motherfucking body. I got busted souls and police watching, nigga, you know?
Living life with a thug, nigga, till the day I die. Living life with a false player.
All eyes on me. It's like what they think, I'm walking around with some keys in my pocket.
All eyes on me.
They think I'm going back to jail. They really on that dope.
Living life with a thug, nigga, till the day I die.
I know y'all watching. I know y'all got me in the scope. I know y'all know this is thug life, baby.